All right, it looks like we are. Let's see, we're broadcasting, we're live. Good. All right, so Larry Johnson, thank you for being on Radiant Creators again. Wanted to have Larry Johnson on again because he's got really profound geopolitical insight on many things, especially the Ukrainian situation and well, FTX as recently has happened also, which is kind of linked to the Ukraine situation in some ways. And it's a show that I've noticed keeps getting profound views that we did several weeks ago, and people are still watching it. So I'm glad you came back on to catch up on the Ukrainian situation. Yeah. So it does look like, I think I saw an article this morning that Lockheed Martin just confirmed, I think like 200 plus a sale of like 200 plus HIMARS to Poland now. That'll be there in like 2023. So that's an interesting development. I mean, maybe that was the plan all along to get some arms sold to Poland as part of the big picture.
Well, this is, think of the, you go to a car dealership and say, I want to get a Bronco. They said, great, dude, give us your down payment and you can pick it up in November of 2023. Well, what good does that do you now? Nothing, no good. It
Yeah.
doesn't do you any good in January or February. So the same thing for Poland. Now, this is, let's call this a long-term corporate welfare program by the U.S. government. And by facilitating these sales to foreign governments, but the delivery is not going to happen for months and in some cases years, it doesn't change the strategic or tactical balance on the battlefield right now or in the near term.
Yeah. And if there was an actual threat to Poland from Russia, which I don't think there is, but besides the point, if there actually was a threat, weapons that would arrive in 2023 really would, at that point, you'd just be, selling them to a carpet bombed country at that point. So it's all pretty silly when you think about it.
Yeah, I mean, if Poland gets them, fine, but I don't think Ukraine will exist in its current form by the end of 2023.
It would be doubtful, especially with some of the crap talking that their leader's been doing recently. So, yeah, I'll just flow down some questions here because I want to get as much info as we can while we're here. So, when it comes to very relevant issues of the day recently, we do have the, and it's alleged. I'm kind of curious about your take on it is the 10 executed Russian soldiers that we've heard
Yeah.
of recently. And do you think that that video is legitimate? I mean, I've seen it, but I myself don't know what to make of it.
Yeah, no, it's legit. And what makes it even more valid is the fact that even the New York Times is confirming that it's legitimate. So when you convince a proven source of lies like the New York Times that they finally come around and embrace it, that the evidence on it's pretty overwhelming. The Russian government, as I understand it, shared it first with the United Nations. And the United Nations is dragging its feet and not reacting to it. But finally, they've reacted. And I think part of the reason they're reacting now goes to the fact that international support for Ukraine is starting to subside. The let's call it the there are frays appearing in that rope that's binding Ukraine to the West. You've had a number of comments and criticisms directed at Ukraine for lying about them, the missile they sent into Poland, trying to blame it on Russia and trying to really start World War III in earnest. They've come into criticism for that. They're now getting criticized as well for carrying out executions that, this looks like something that ISIS was doing to captured soldiers down in Syria or in other countries, or what the Germans did to partisans during World War II. You line them up, shoot them in the back of the head. So it's starting to resonate, and I think the support for Zelensky, it's starting to diminish.
Yeah, and yeah, such murder does also make you think about Bandera and his, kind of what he did to the Poles and such, like anyone that they could get their hands on that they didn't like. So it seems like an extraordinary bad move, and it's tragic. It certainly shouldn't happen. I think that it's a hard thing to sell anybody who was ever in the military, especially because, I mean, surrender happens. Sometimes you get cut off. And when you can't surrender, if you know you're going to be killed, that definitely changes the tone of the battle and definitely the vengeance that you'll see on the battlefield. I think that, yeah. Do you think this is going to make, the war right now begin to be more devastating towards the Ukrainian forces? I don't see many Russian soldiers having any empathy, if they did at all, at this point.
The war is already brutal.
Yeah.
The number of Ukrainians being killed is pretty substantial. This is the kind of thing where this is why you're supposed to have military order and discipline to prevent people from acting on emotions. Leadership is supposed to help counter the emotional reaction and do things in a proper way. It happened during World War II where,
yes,
when Japanese soldiers would feign that they were dead or wounded, and then they'd pull out a hand grenade and blow up any Americans that came to their aid. What happened is the U.S. Marines started killing them all. They stopped taking prisoners. They just killed them because they weren't going to take that risk anymore. So that happens. And it does, you know, augur the possibility of making this conflict much more brutal than it already is. It's already extremely bloody.
Yeah, it's brutal as it is. And when you see such things happen, I know that they can happen as a one-off. These things can happen outside of a command's, consent, of course. But to do something so blatant in the open and to even video it and ultimately make that video available to the world, it would seem to me, at least, that reflects the leadership's will. I know that's a bit of a stretch, but that such things don't tend to happen under good leadership.
They did before. The Ukrainians murdered people in Bucha, mm-hmm, staged the bodies, and then tried to blame it on the Russians as a Russian war crime, when all the available evidence showed that Russia had left the area a couple of days before the Ukrainians came in and before those bodies appeared. So, you know, they've done it before. Candidly, they've been killing civilians without any repercussions for the last 8, going on 9 years.
Yeah.
And the West has done little, if anything, to try to stop it or sanction them. So I guess shouldn't be surprised that they would do something like this now, because it's really been a habit. Once you're able to do it and get away with it, you keep doing it.
Yeah, and there was the videos that came out, gosh, what was it? Was it a year or was it months ago, where you had the Ukrainian troops, you know, shooting Russian POWs earlier, you know?
Yeah, that was in March.
Yeah, and so I think definitely that is a precedence that gets harder and harder to sell the world. And it's, you know, something that did want to chat about also, is that it does seem that, we are seeing Ukraine fatigue, definitely in Europe, of course, I think, even more so than the U.S. And, of course, Ukraine fatigue here, and the story gets harder to believe. It's like you mentioned the New York Times. I think their actual exact words were like, Russian state media has videos that have raised questions about Ukrainian soldiers committing war crimes. So the New York Times didn't want to take it really head on, but they were forced to touch on it and say, well, there's some alleged video that maybe possibly points to something. And yeah, right. for the New York Times to come out and say that is a big deal. It means that ultimately damage control really can't be done as far as covering it up and denying it. And then I think it was the International Business Times, actually, they hopped on that and said Ukraine war crime. New York Times report beefs up Russian charge that Kiev executed 10 Russian prisoners. So the New York Times, at least saying it's a alleged possibility, has definitely affected the international, I would say, media on the situation.
Yeah,
for sure. Yeah. And I don't think that's what you could say, I just call it the collective West really wants as far as narrative. So I think it's a big deal that that's come to light and continues. So we'll see how that plays out. And then one other topic is, you have recent post up on your site. It's sonar21.com. Check it out, everybody, while you're listening. And it's called, you know, "For the Love of God, Someone Tell Putin He's Out of Precision Missiles." And I think it's a great it's a great way to put it, because, hey, somebody tell them they're out of munitions and ammo and such. And to me, that story that we've been hearing, gosh, it's going to be pretty much a year plus years. It's going to be quite a while we've been hearing it play out. And I think what was Tuesday, their heaviest, I guess, missile strikes on Ukraine. So do you think anybody's buying that narrative any longer? And do you think Russia's anywhere near out of stuff to shoot at Ukraine?
Well, this is what is so fascinating about that claim. I first heard it towards the end of March from a friend who's still in the intelligence community, and he had access to current intelligence, military intelligence. And he told me at the end of March that, he says, what my bosses, you know, the senior commanders, were hoping was that Russia was going to run out of missiles soon. They didn't know. They didn't have any solid intelligence. They had no idea exactly how much Russia had in its inventory. And so the intelligence community itself was predicating their assessments on hope, you know, belief, sort of like a religious experience. Oh, we hope, we believe it's going to be so. And then after that, the Ukrainians started feeding that story. So this is, you know, the lies about the missile that landed in Poland is just, it's an extension of everything that's come out of Ukraine. They claimed, you remember the ghost of
Ghost of Kiev. Yeah,
you know, this wondrous fighter pilot who's shooting down Russian aircraft right and left, and it was a video game. You get the Bucha massacre, where that is blamed on Russia. They had nothing to do with it. And then you've got the Ukrainians claiming that they're killing, you know, tens of thousands of Russians, and the Russians are suffering terrible losses, when it's not true. Or on top of that, then all Russia's, they're at the end of the rope. They're retreating. There's chaos. You know, the other story is like Vladimir Putin has cancer. No.
Yeah.
He's got Parkinson's disease. No. And I always say he's got heartbreak of psoriasis. You know, it's just, it's gotten to the point of just being utterly ridiculous. And so here, finally, you had the Institute for the Study of War predicting, like a day before the massive missile strike, you know, it's questionable if Russia has any more missiles to launch. And boom, here it comes, the largest ever. What this reflects is gross ignorance on the part of not just the public and the punditry in this country, but even our own intelligence community, a failure to appreciate the size of Russia's industrial base. Oftentimes, Russia has been, dismissed as an inconsequential economic force in the world. There's just described as a gas station for the wealthy countries. That on top of it, that they don't produce anything of any significance, and yet the people saying that are ignoring the fact that since 2004, the United States has had to rely upon Russian rockets in order to carry our astronauts to the space station.
Okay? Wow.
The United States hasn't been able to produce, the U.S. government through NASA has not produced a viable rocket for transporting personnel since for 18 years. And, you know, we're now relying on Elon Musk and maybe Jeff Bezos of Amazon, you know, that they can produce their ships. But so the fact that Russia can produce rocket engines that are the top of the class in the world for transporting people to outer space may mean that their economy is not some backwater leather shop, you know, where they're making purses and belts and trying to sell those to tourists. that we ignore the fact that during World War II, that Russia's industrial capability, despite being attacked and invaded, have almost matched the United States. In fact, in the production of tanks from the period of January 1st, 1942, through the end of 1944, Russia produced more tanks per month than the United States. Just, you know, think about that. So a country, they did not lose that that production capability. That's one of the things that has that makes really Russia so viable in the modern world, is it is really a self-sufficient country. It does not need critical minerals or rare earth minerals from other countries in order to produce advanced weaponry, because it has it there at home. United States, however, is in an absolute dismal shape, as is illustrated by, you know, going back to the point you made earlier about getting the HIMARS to Poland. Oh, yeah, we'll get it to you in 2023. What happened with, hey, yeah, we get it produced and get it to you at the end of the month?
Yeah.
Remember during World War II, the United States was producing 147 naval ships per month.
Wow.
Right now, it takes the United States 5 to 7 years to produce just one aircraft carrier. So,
yeah.
So you got to put all that together to understand that, you know, Russia is a much more formidable force and is able to produce these missiles, these high precision missiles, drones, and other things, because they've got factories going 24/7. And they have an educated workforce that can produce the items, and they've got the materials that they need to produce it.
Yeah, and that's a question that we hear from some of the, you know, articles that I see, and is, you know, where is Russia? You know, like they never approach the reality that Russia could just be making munitions as they need them. Probably, of course, they have a stockpile, I'm sure, but that never really gets broached, that they're just making them. They don't have to buy them from anybody. They may be getting some from other countries, of course, and other sources, but they can make them. I mean, so that's something that it seems to get missed in the collective Western media, I think, that Russia, well, not only do they got plenty, they can make it as they need it. And 5 to 7 years for an aircraft carrier, I could understand that for an aircraft carrier, just one of them, but even that, almost a little bit off topic, but you start wondering, are aircraft carriers a dated item anyway? You
know, they are.
Yeah.
It is the equivalent for modern warfare with hypersonic missiles in the mix. It's the same effect as what happened when the machine gun was introduced in the First World War and what it did to horse cavalry. Because up to that point, horses were the way that you would transport troops. You know, having a cavalry gave you a mobile unit to move quickly and to attack in force and concentrate an attack. Well, along comes the machine gun. Whoop! The horses were no longer, you know, they're not bulletproof.
They're not bulletproof, and it reminds me of European armor. European, you know, body armor was profound the way it had been. It was amazing even to see it today. You look at some of the craftsmanship and how they did it and how it articulated. I mean, these guys could wear some seriously heavy, you know, plate metal all over their body, and it was flexible and moved, and they could fight in it. But the musket, yeah, that's it. That armor was over in a day. You know, all those many, you know, centuries, generations of perfection, and well, one musket ball, and well, that was over. It wasn't worth the wait anymore.
Yeah. So what's happened now is with one of the three legs of the U.S. Defense strategy. So we got the land-based intercontinental ballistic missiles. We've got the air-launched cruise missiles and the ballistic missiles that can carry nuclear weaponry, and then we have the sea-launched. And the aircraft carriers are really our only way of projecting force overseas. You can't, we don't have a big enough plane to haul a regiment of soldiers. you got to need several planes to haul a bunch of soldiers. So moving, putting soldiers on ships is the one way to move a large force. Aircraft carriers can provide, used to be able to provide some air cover for activities, but now with a hypersonic missile, it can reach out to, I understand, 2,000 kilometers. Those ships can be sunk. And there's nothing on board the ships in terms of missile defense that can shoot down hypersonic missiles. So yeah, the United States has to be very, very, very careful these days about where it's going to place those ships. I'm really sort of puzzled and bemused and shocked by the tough talk about Taiwan and how we're going to defend. How exactly are we going to do that? Because China faces its own problem trying to get troops to that island, but they have a much easier task than we do. If we put any ship out there intending to land troops on Taiwan, they'd be blown out of the water by the Chinese.
Yeah.
The other thing I heard was they were lamenting the fact that we don't have artillery shells for our troops to operate in the Pacific theater. Excuse me? Just where are you going to deploy, let's say, a 155 millimeter howitzer so it can fire on China? That means you're going to have to either land on China or put it on a floating barge that's going to then be blown up. So this, we've got military capabilities that don't necessarily match the task in front of them. And going back to the point earlier about production, we're supposedly buying 100,000 of the 155 millimeter rounds, howitzer rounds from South Korea to send to Ukraine because we can't produce enough here in this country. And it sounds like a lot, except if the Ukrainians use it at the rate that the Russians fire ships, that's not even 2 days worth of ammunition.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, definitely. And it's South Korea. That's an interesting place to get your howitzer rounds from. I think the other ones to make PMC ammo, which anybody who shoots knows PMC,
Yes, yes.
So I wonder if those howitzer rounds come in a big crate that says PMC on it. I want to picture that if it exists.
Yeah.
I definitely want to see that. Well, so, and that's the thing I also wonder about when it comes to the time of the fleet, with the aircraft carrier in the middle. I'm not sure if, I do know during World War II or after, I remember reading about Russia at least having the notion of if not developing the nuclear torpedo, and if that does exist out there, then it's over. Fleets in general become kind of obsolete.
I think Russia, as my understanding, has deployed such a thing.
Oh, you broke up for a second. They have or they haven't?
Yeah, they have. They have deployed such a weapon.
Yeah. So then, once again, even more so, fleets become. I like aircraft carriers. They're cool, but the West, or you say America, does have much less of an ability to project force when that is just great. Ultimately, a big target. It's all a matter of how do you take it out.
Right. Yeah. Well, again, not to keep going back to World War II, but we got to have a benchmark, something to compare to. As I recall, I don't know the precise time, but we were producing so many aircraft carriers. I think they could produce one every 2 or 3 months.
That's amazing. Yeah.
I mean, it's really because you go back, we only had 2 or 3 at the start of the war. Well, when the war started, Yorktown was sunk. I think there were only 2 or 3. And by the end of the war, I think there was something like 30.
Mm.
Pop them out of thin air. The fact that the United States, you got it, because when you're building these ships, think about it, you've got to have a reliable supply of steel. And you've got to have all the machine tooled screws and bolts and wiring. And I just, there's so many different products that go into that ship. And you have to have a supply system that can produce and deliver.
Oh, yeah.
Now,
Yeah. And you need like a battalion of plumbers and electricians alone to get one of those things done. So, yeah, I mean, it's quite a lot. And it's just copper wire. There you go. I mean, a remarkable amount. So, well, that article you wrote, of course, you know, for love of God, someone tell Putin he's out of precision missiles, which people can check out over at, you know, sonar21.com. But it does seem one of the things that I've been realizing in this conflict that something America does, and like, I like the F-35, sure, it's cool. And maybe if it actually can do all things, you know, it's an A-10 and an F-18, right? If it's all these things, if it actually can do all of that, maybe the money spent will ultimately have been worth it. But so far, it seems like it, you know, breaks a lot. Where Russia, on the other hand, you know, after World War II, they began working on air defense systems because I think they realized that America had quite, they had seen we had quite the air force. So they went, well, we can't match that right away, but let's work on air defenses. And that's something it seems like, you know, has America, it seems like when you look at Russia and you look at America, our, the way we viewed the defense industry, you might say, or defending the country is very different, where it seems like America is like, let's spend a lot of money and make an F-35, where Russia is like, let's retroactively fix a bunch of the models of MiGs to land on dirt roads and stuff like that. So it's practical versus just a huge expenditure.
Well, it's the here's the fundamental difference between Russia and the United States. The United States procurement, the process for designing and buying weapons and deploying weapons, is subject entirely to politics.
Yes,
it's not predicated on a national security strategy. In other words, there's not a written out defined doctrine that's guiding what we're doing. Instead, oftentimes it's you get the people, members of Congress, who will contribute money to make sure the money goes to Lockheed Martin because Lockheed Martin is contributing money to them. So the lobbying firms that get hired by Lockheed Martin or by Raytheon, or that they then go to the Hill and they get certain members of Congress to back certain legislation, and they get that in exchange for money. It's really a form of legalized bribery.
Yeah.
So, that's on the U.S. side. Whereas on the Russian side, what's going on is they actually have a plan, and they're designing weaponry that is set to defend Mother Russia. It is designed to resist both missile and aerial attacks, as well as ground force attacks. And that, you know, that is part of the reason why Russia's annual defense budget is, I believe, less than $80 million.
Wow.
Whereas the United States is approaching $800 billion.
Yeah.
So between $80 billion and $800 billion, it's unbelievable. And so the reason it's so expensive in the United States is there are so many middlemen and middlewomen who, you know, get their palms greased as the procurement process goes forward. So it is, you know, a complete disconnect. And add to this, when George W. Bush withdrew in 2001 from the Anti-Ballistic Missile Defense Treaty on the pretext that, he wanted the United States to be free to develop its missile defense system. Then along comes 9/11, they get distracted, and the United States has devoted its time to fighting the war against terrorism. The Russians went and moved immediately to developing anti-ballistic missile defense systems, both against aircraft and against missiles. I mean, candidly, if it can shoot down a hypersonic missile, it sure as hell could shoot down a jet.
Oh yeah.
The only difference is you got a pilot in one and not in the other.
Yeah. And that's true. So I mean, it does seem like it's a very good strategy there. And I was going to mention the lawnmower drones that we're hearing so much about, you know, recently. I think it's an interesting history of how they were developed. I think what was it like? I forget what country developed it first, and another country captured one, then developed it further. But interesting history on the lawnmower drone. But one of the things about that And I found very impressive. Now, this is something I heard. I mean, to me, it's that I haven't confirmed it, but that the lawnmower drone, of course, it's not very big and it moves slow. And I guess its signature that the radar can see, and because it's very quiet, it has a gas engine. I think some of the original ones weren't prop. They had a jet engine. Well, I saw some videos of a bunch of these things over Ukrainian cities, you know, coming in for a landing. And it sounds like a bunch of flying lawnmowers, you know. And so I guess that they trick what missile defense systems they have, if any, at this point. It just looks like birds. I guess they designed those to mock the speed of birds flying in a flock. And so all they can't detect. I mean, that's low tech genius.
Yeah, I mean, there are a variety of technologies that can be used for air defense. And this is why what the Russians have an actual integrated system. And by integrated, it means you've got the missiles on the ground that are going to be fired at an incoming target that is tied in communication with satellite systems, with aerial platforms that are collecting other information. That information is being downloaded to one site and then distributed so that you can actually know if you're going to target something by its heat signature, or if you're going to target something with, let's call it GPS coordinates, because you've been able to locate, identify it, and track its movement. That the United States does not have a system like that. We don't have a fully integrated air defense system comparable to what Russia has. So we're immediately at a disadvantage. The United States believes that its stealth aircraft would be able to allow U.S. planes to penetrate Russian airspace, bomb critical locations, and disable the Russian military or Russian defense system. I think that is a crazy bet. The reality is that Russia, I think, will easily handle anything, any of our stealth aircraft, whether it's, you know, B-2 bomber or F-35, you know, whatever you're flying, it's gonna pick it up.
Yeah, definitely. And how many missions can they actually successfully make without, you know, major maintenance? Anyhow, I don't know how many we have, but how many sorties could they do before they're down for the count? Anyway, something's going to hit it. Well, along with that, it reminds me of when I was in the, and this leads on to something else, this kind of next topic. When I was in the military, one of my collateral duties was land navigation. So one of the things I did was when I was on duty, when I was sitting in Saudi Arabia, was I'd sit in front of the big map that we have there. I knew where our camp was. And when the Scuds were fired, the AWACS plane would see it and broadcast its coordinates and the azimuth that was flying. And then we'd know if we cared or not. And something that gets me is there's a, it's something that actually that the Duran mentioned this morning, an article from Newsweek, Americans are running out of patience with Biden's approach to Putin's war, but also the whole Ukraine fatigue. But this kind of leads into the missiles that went into Poland. Mm-hmm. I think one of the things is, if you look at the map, they're kind of two different directions. Why would Ukraine be defending itself from Russian missiles over Poland? Doesn't quite make sense. But also, I take it that those are Ukrainian missiles that were shot that direction, but even if somehow there was an error, from what I understood when I was in the military, we used to watch the Patriots go after the Scuds over our heads. We could see it in the distance, you know.
Yeah. Okay.
And by the way, sometimes they would miss. Sometimes they would just hit and like knock the Scud off course, which was a beautiful pain in the ass, you know. But because we knew where it was going, now we don't. But the thing is, if the Ukraine by accident fired those into Poland, I understood that we could, at least in the Patriot days, we could disable it in flight. You could say it's not going where we wanted it to. We could abort it and turn it off, and it's just this big piece of metal that lands. I mean, couldn't those missiles have been deactivated if they realized they fired them in the wrong direction? I think.
I don't think. I think they were old enough They were so old that they did not have that technology capability.
Gotcha.
The thing, I know many continuous systems, it was just an accident. Horse shit. That was not an accident at all. And the reason I say that is, number one, and I've talked to some, some of the explanation out of the U.S. Intel is that you had a SAM battery, a surface-to-air missile battery, with this S-300 on it, this S-300 system, to the east of Lviv. So that's where the battery is set up. And then there are only three possible directions that an incoming rocket, missile from Russia would be fired: from the south, from the north, from Belarus, which there's no evidence they're firing from Belarus, or from the east. So we're told that what the U.S. government wants you to believe is that the missile's coming like this, and then the SAM battery shoots it from behind, lets it get past it, and then shoots at it and misses. That is, again, you want to see it coming at you. You don't want to wait till it gets past you. That's number one. Number two, they were out so quickly, both Kiev and Warsaw, and condemning this as a Russian strike. And by God, we need to enact Article 5. I mean, that was a week ago today that this was going on, or a week ago tomorrow, please. They were so quick off the trigger that, to me, that says that was design. Because if they shot the missile in the air and did not know where it went, then obviously they had some, it's going to be all before they come telling them, this is where this missile landed, plus whatever damage it did in Poland. The other thing is the United States and Russia, with our satellite systems, they've got satellites specifically dedicated to detecting launches of this kind of missile, because you never know if it's a ICBM headed towards you or not. So, U.S. and Russia were both tracking this early on. Could know, where it was fired from, who fired it, and was there any other missile-carrying trajectory that would have been possibly in line that they could have been trying to shoot down. Then the timing of it with the G20 summit, to get this happening as the G20 was meeting. And it coincided also with the release from the International Tribunal at The Hague, accusing Russia of shooting down an airliner 8 years ago. So when you put all that together, I think this was a deliberate psyop. And the fact that Ukraine continues to insist that it's Russian, and everyone else is going, no, it's not. And so they've undermined their credibility. I don't understand why they could be considered having had credibility in the first place. But
yeah, and that's the thing that gets me, is you'll still have Zelensky out there saying, well, we don't know, whose missiles they are, because they won't let us see them, but they're Russian, or something like that. Ridiculous statements for a leader to be making. And that's where I think we might be seeing, where even Newsweek has to admit it, Ukraine fatigue, because it can take a while for people to kind of get with something. I get it. But I think we might look in the history books in the future one day and find that this is in this conflict, this is one thing that we'll read, that a Ukrainian farmer stopped World War III because he took pictures and posted them. Because what if that hadn't happened? And now, this is somewhat high octane speculation, but they were fired near a fertilizer plant, which would have made a big mess. So were they actually trying to hit that and did not? That would have changed things. You wouldn't have known what missiles those were right away, if at all possible. You wouldn't have known fast enough. So it's really something. And to me, the idea of it being an accident, well, I don't know. I mean, I was in the military, so I look at it. You don't just fire missiles by accident in the military. It doesn't happen. People don't. No. That's No, it doesn't happen. I don't know what the Ukrainian military is like, but I'm sure there's enough discipline where no one's going to fire missiles off towards Poland by accident. It's just, I can't see it. It's got to be via orders. You know, you're not going to do that kind of thing by chance. And so, along with that, you've got, this is where a lot of the Ukraine fatigue, I think, is happening. And this, I think, is a good thing to see. And like you mentioned, the Ukraine, Zelensky losing credibility. And actually, as we see, beginning to slide into the media, the mainstream media, I would say, is this guy dangerous? Is he leading the war the world towards, you know, war with saying things that are untrue? And I'm not sure if it was true, but supposedly, I think it was just, you know, posturing, but supposedly on a conference call, President Biden saying, you know, be more appreciative or something like that. And I'm not sure if he really said that or not, but at least it shows that they're beginning to have to show a positioning that is not completely positive, you know, here in the collective West. So along with that, you've got, and this is something that I'm wondering about is, so of course you have FTX and you've blogged about that. You've done some great posts on that, but that definitely was a money laundering. I mean, there's so much coming out by the hour. I stopped even following it. I'm going to check back on it in a bit because there's just too much coming out to even follow it right now. But but we do know that definitely was a massive money laundering machine. And how do you think that actually coming to an end, which it has rather quickly, how do you think that affects the Ukraine fatigue? I think that's actually a huge blow to the war itself because, you know, when people are in trouble, they tend to want to cover their tracks and be quiet.
Well, it's several things. So let's be precise about the term money laundering.
Yeah.
Because I've spent my company, we spent 24 years investigating and doing money laundering cases. If money laundering constitutes an act of where you've got cash that has been derived from an illegal activity, whether it's child trafficking, prostitution, drugs, illegal narcotics, arms trafficking. So there's a predicate crime that generates a financial flow from that. Then that you're trying to hide the origin of those proceeds. In this case with FTX, yes, there was some money laundering involved because I'm given to understand that FTX was being used in part to move financial assets that came from the sale of fentanyl and some other narcotics. But what you've also got going on is fraud and the effort to raise money to get money to the Democrat Party by getting funds that are raised ostensibly for Ukraine, and then that money goes into the purchase with cryptocurrency at FTX, and then cryptocurrency, the FTX people ostensibly turn around and donate that, convert it into fiat cash, you know, regular dollars and euros, and then give that to Zelensky. But within that, they were then turning around and giving money back to the Democrats and to the public as well. I mean, Mitch McConnell reportedly received $5 million. They got to add to his PAC. They got to ask, what world relationship does he have with Samuel Bankman Fried to deserve getting $2.5 million? Now, maybe from McConnell's standpoint, that's, you know, chicken feed. It doesn't really amount to much, but it was a significant donation. So it's one way to, you know, if you will, to get the quid pro quo of saying appropriate dollars to go to Ukraine, appropriate money that's going to purchase weapons that will go to Ukraine, and then we'll in turn, the Ukrainians will send money back to the United States. It's almost like you're appropriating money for yourself, but it's going through a cutout. Now that could constitute violations of the Corrupt Practices Act, Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, among other things. So this entire significant portion of this operation was set up in such a way to obscure where the money was coming from and where it was going. And within that, you have intermingling of funds, some from criminal activities, some from legitimate activities, some diverted from where it was supposed to go. And so it's a mess, as to put it simply.
It certainly is, and it's and it does explain, well, actually, you know, I do wonder how that will, I think the FTX situation will still continue to unravel, and we'll see a lot of damage done from it. I do think it's like 130 companies have gone bankrupt. I heard it was one number for, because or they were affected financially by it. So, I mean, yeah. It just unravels and unravels and unravels. And especially, I think that they kind of, it's the wrong crew to have screwed over, you might say, because the crypto community are pretty shrewd, pretty smart people. And you've got a lot of blockchain, you know, blockchain analysis that can be done. And so I'm not sure how you can track US dollars. That's not my thing. But I do know in crypto, none of it's anonymous. So in a sense, I think they're going to nail every single person who saw, if you were involved in a crypto transaction or if it was involved in the money movement, you're screwed. They're going to have an arrow pointing straight to and from.
Yeah, because that's what a lot of the people, I think, particularly the politicians that got ensnared in this whole thing, were told it would they would be anonymous.
Yeah, nope.
And trusted that. And now they're going to discover, whoops, not only is it not anonymous, it is more easily traceable than trying to track, say you've got a suitcase load of $100 bills. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, unless you have marked them in advance, you get a tough time proving that money, you know, get fall that money. It's not an electronic transaction, it's a transaction.
Yeah. And so I think that it's really something that we've heard so much about, you know, crypto needing to be regulated because it's, you know, it can be used for all these terrible things. And then, well, who did it, right? In a big way. I don't think there's any scammer bigger than this, than FTX, as far as using cryptocurrency explicitly to do something nefarious, you know, that I know of at least. And so it kind of explains, that's one of the things that, so all the conservatives who pushed for, you know, Ukrainian aid, well, you bet against, you hedge the bets against yourself, you know, you're funding the other side. And that definitely explains how, when it looked like the House and Senate might go to the red side of the House, the Republicans, there was that last ditch push. We need to get more aid because the political, because our ability to send it may change if the House and the Senate flip. You know, it definitely explains that last-ditch effort, which I don't think they quite pulled off. So I do think that the FTX situation may affect the war in Ukraine, only in that it may have exposed too much and begin to slow the machine down some.
Well, I think that's already started. There is, I think there's a decided shift in the tone of the Biden administration vis-a-vis Ukraine compared to prior to the election. So once it was clear that the Republicans are going to take control of the House of Representatives, the easy ability to go up to the Hill and get them to rubber stamp more money for Ukraine, those days are over. As the economic problems in the United States grow more severe, that is, a lot of it's hidden right now. I give you one quick example. In Florida, I got a notice that, oh boy, we're back up. The demand for real estate's going up. But then you can dig down into the numbers. The inventory now is out to almost 3 months. It used to be there was no inventory. You know, a year ago this time, there was no inventory. It was just people were buying houses up before they could even be put on the market. Now they're staying on market for at least 3 months. That's a big change. So that's a sign that the economy's slowing because the ability to purchase these houses is being drawn out longer. You're seeing this already in Europe. They announced in the UK that they are in recession and that, you know, people are going to be losing jobs. And all of this comes in the face of rising prices. So you're losing jobs, no income, and paying higher prices. That is a deadly mix. I've seen it before in places like Argentina in 1984. It's a nightmare scenario. Just really devastates the society. And you've got thousands taking to the streets today, I think, in Greece, in Athens. It looked to be around 10, 15,000 people marching in protest. So yeah. you're going to face growing domestic opposition across Europe to continue to send money and military aid to Ukraine while their own economies are being devastated.
Yeah, I think that Thanksgiving might be an interesting time here in the country, here in the U.S., because people are aware that inflation is quite extreme by the gas prices, by food prices. And when everybody's getting together this holiday season, I'm sure one of the things people will be talking about is, man, this is really expensive.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's like it cost me like, you know, 30 bucks to drive here. And now everything, and it's insane. Well, also, you talk about the protests. You know, Brazil, for instance, they're definitely not taking their elections lying down. Those protests are getting bigger and bigger and bigger. They don't seem to want to have their leader dictated by American election standards.
I mean, good Lord, we've become a complete joke. The split that's down in Brazil between the Bolsonaro and the Lula followers is very reminiscent of the split here in the United States. We've actually got a split between, let's call it, Republicans and Democrats, and then we have another split between the establishment Republicans and the populists, Donald Trump. And this is a recipe for chaos. We're already seeing the diesel prices going up, diesel shortages going up, and now the railroad's likelihood of a railroad strike with further supply chain disruption. It's not a pretty picture for the U.S. economy. And we certainly don't have any kind of political leadership in Washington, at least in the White House, capable of dealing with it. So it's going to be the ability to sustain support for Ukraine, I believe, is going to become more difficult with each passing week.
Yeah, and I definitely hope that it does. And I think that hopefully people are learning the deeper reasons for us being there. You know, I always, whenever I, you know, it comes up in conversation, I always recommend people go watch Ukraine on Fire. There's a good place to start.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Just start there, and that's all true, you know, and you just take it from there. And I think even that knowledge of, hey, all the people that were involved in that, they're in power again. You know, and look what's happening. So yeah, that rabbit hole goes on forever. But even if a person just starts there, it should, if they have any critical thinking skills, make them realize that what's going on is not in the country's best interest.
Right. Yeah. No. This is devastating. You got to wonder how Ukraine itself can survive. I mean, right now they're on life support without the steady flow of billions of dollars a month from the West, United States and Europe. The government has no way to fund itself. Yeah. They can't operate a factory really of any consequence in Ukraine now because it's all vulnerable to Russian missile strikes. So the tax base is basically gone. Some of the key resource areas that made Ukraine potentially one of the richest countries in the world in terms of mineral resources and grains and other things and fuels, those are gone. Those are now controlled by Russia. So this is, and they're in the early grips of winter. It's going to be ugly.
Yeah. And the occasional, in the Western media, you will see occasionally, oh, well, it's winter. There'll be a break. It's like, no, Russians love the winter. Are you kidding? They're going to,
They're not going to stop.
It's not going to slow them down one bit. In fact, I mean, winter is oftentimes easy. Of course, as we know, it's easier to travel. For one thing, you can cross the river because it's frozen. You know, care if there's a bridge there or not. So, you know, people don't always realize that to our ancestors, our pioneering ancestors, winter often meant the ability to travel places you could not before and easier, even though it was cold. So we've been talking for a little while. I don't want to keep you more than an hour, you know. I'm sure I've got
another appointment at 2:15 here.
Perfect. So I'll just finish up with I wanted to touch on what happens after, I know I'm projecting it here a little bit, but what happens after Russia wins the war, or as we continue this conflict? Because already we saw Italian police bust Azov-tied Nazi cell planning terror attack. You know, it was a pretty well-written story. I saw that. And so I do wonder, something that I sort of fear, but I think I have to kind of take as a possibility, will we see, since we are dealing with ideological Nazis to a certain extent, there's definitely that. Are we going to see attacks on, you know, European countries that aren't supporting Ukraine?
Yes. No, I think that's definitely a possibility. I mean, the amount of, let's call it loose weaponry that's out there on the black market is significant, and it's very deadly. So the ideal solution here is that Ukraine's going to run out of gas, literally and figuratively and metaphorically, and then we'll negotiate a settlement with Russia that they will cede the territory, cede Odessa, and recognize that Crimea is Russia's, and then that they're swear off any continued ties to the West. I frankly don't, you know, would be the idea, but I think they're going to be very hard pressed to do that. This is the level of corruption here is such that you've got, you know, politicians bought and paid for, and very close economic ties. You know, it's not just the Bidens. It's John Kerry's family, Ryan's family, Nancy Pelosi and her family. I've got all the political elite in Washington that have financial interests in Ukraine.
Yeah.
So what is going to, a Russian victory, I think, will make, you know, start the unraveling of NATO. Because up to this point, the only way NATO could maintain military force was by adding new countries, because they weren't going to build up a new army in the UK and a bigger army in Finland and in Norway and Germany. So the way they did it is they added countries, and with each new country came a new military unit to add to their quote force strength. It was, you know, it was a foolish idea in the beginning. It's not very practical in terms of actually being able to organize and deploy that force and use it in any coherent fashion because of the differences in language and the differences in culture, even though they tried to standardize it. All it was just an excuse, part of this emptying out countries like Hungary and Croatia and Romania, getting rid of their Soviet-era weaponry, sending it to Ukraine so it gets chewed up in war. Those countries now have to turn around and buy NATO-approved equipment, which is manufactured largely by the United States. And so, again, it's just another boondoggle for the U.S. military-industrial corporations.
Yeah. Yeah, it always seemed like NATO was kind of dated. Like once Russia fell apart, it seemed like, and the Warsaw Pact fell apart, I could see keeping NATO around for a decade. But long gone is the Russia of Stalin and such. So it always seemed like it was a bit of a thing that would eventually lead to ruin anyway, if nothing else, financial ruin.
Right.
And I mean, as I'll let you go, because it's been great talking to you. But one last slight question I'd ask. This is kind of high octane speculation, but I do think that, Could this situation sort of be summarized in a way that it's not just happening, it's that we are moving into a unipolar world, especially with currencies and such and commodities, and this has already happened, it's already kind of done. So it is really the rise of the BRIC nations, and yes, it seems like this is simply, I oftentimes think that you had some people sitting around the room with the cigars and vodka and whiskey and such, and they decided that it was time for the better of the BRICS, just for the changing world, that NATO be taken out. And that's what this has always been about anyway. And it's kind of a certainty. It seems like it to me.
In the same way that dropping the bomb on Hiroshima on August 8th, 1945, ended World War II with respect to Japan, but the actual signing ceremony didn't take place till 2 or 3 weeks later.
Yeah.
That they're formally ended. I think when history is written, they will point to the rush to be start of the Russian special military operation on February 24th of 2022 as the beginning of the end of U.S. dominance in the international community, the end of U.S. supremacy. It is now going to be a multipolar world that the United States will have far less control over. And it's a reality that is going to be slow and coming upon us, but we're going to have to come to grips with it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, if it all rolls out smoothly, and I hope it does, then, well, it'll be a better world when this is all over and all the suffering will have at least led to something, you know, good. Well, Larry Johnson, check out sonar21.com. It's all of his stuff is there. And I will get this posted over to Rumble. We've had trouble live streaming there, so this is only live streaming on YouTube, but I will put it on Rumble and I'll send you that link. It's been great talking to you so much. Thank you so much for being on again.
This always enjoy it, Craig.
Great enlightenment. So thank you so much.
All right, but we'll talk.
All right, bye-bye.
Take care.
You too.